This is Phil Davidson, and with me today is Rockford Symphony Orchestra Music Director Stephen Larson, and we are discussing the RSO's Classics 1 concert, The Pines of Rome, on Saturday, September 28th, 7:30 p.m., at the Coronado Performing Arts Center. And we will actually get to The Pines of Rome here in a few minutes, but the program kicks off with a symphony in E minor, Opus 32, by Amy Beach, who is an American composer. The symphony was kind of a first for an American woman, I believe, wasn't it?
It was. It was the first symphony to be performed by a major orchestra. I don't know how far we want to get into dig into history to find out that there was an exception to this, but the first that anybody knows about that was written by a woman, performed by a major orchestra, was written by Amy Beach.
Hmm.
And that was written in 1897.
And she began her, we'll call it, musical journey when she was quite young.
Yeah, she was quite a prodigy. She began playing the piano at age 4 and performed her first concert soon after that, and had performed with the Boston Symphony as a teenager and written quite a bit of music. She was really quite something, quite remarkable at any age, but particularly for a woman at that time in the late 19th century to be writing music and performing like that. She was quite something. But at age 18, she married a well-to-do Boston physician who was 28 years, I believe, older than she, and became a Boston Society matron. At his behest, he didn't believe it was proper for a young woman to be performing on her own, making a career as a pianist. He didn't believe it was right that she should teach. Teaching was a little bit like, wealthy women who taught piano, it might be seen as needing pin money. You certainly didn't want to do that. And she was fine with this, and she performed and composed for the rest of her life under the name of Mrs. H.H.A. Beach, taking her husband's name. You look back at the time and think, oh, well, yeah, this is terrible that this woman was forced into this subservient role. But no, this is just the way things were. All through the 19th century, women were not allowed to become music professionals. They were encouraged to play the piano. They were encouraged to sing. They could write music if they wanted to, but they weren't allowed to study orchestral instruments with the idea of performing as a member of an orchestra. It was just simply off limits. Even to the middle of the 20th century, all the major orchestras in the world were exclusively male. So this was just something of the time. Clara Schumann, in a way, was a little bit like Amy Beach when she was young. She was also a prodigy. She was also a prolific composer. She wrote a piano concerto when she was 14. But when she married Robert, the idea was that she was now going to be a wife. She could continue performing, and she could teach, but she was not going to be a composer. And not going to be a real professional in that sense. Composing was a man's job, and you had to be a man. This is kind of funny in a way, but there was this idea that to compose symphonies, you had to be a male because only the male energy could really write serious music.
Huh.
So, at one time, bad air was supposed to cause malaria. You know, the times change.
The symphony in E minor is often referred to as the Gaelic symphony.
Yes.
Can you describe the music and how it ties in with the Gaelic?
Well, the Gaelic refers to Amy Cheney was her maiden name. She had Irish roots. And so she was reaching back to some Irish influenced tunes. You really hear this in the third movement of the symphony, which we're not playing. We're only playing the fourth movement. But I think that a first-time listener would be hard-pressed to pick out something that they thought was really, truly Irish. There are no quotes of O'Danny Boy or the Irish Washerwoman or something like that. It's not a folk song symphony. But she did use some Gaelic, her roots, as inspiration, perhaps taking Dvorak's advice. Dvorak wrote his New World Symphony in 1893, and he was brought over to this country for the specific purpose of teaching Americans how to write music in their own style. I don't know whether Amy Beach knew about this or was influenced at all by him, but rather than look to music of the African-American spirituals or the so-called Indian music, Native Indian music, she reached back into apparently melodies she remembered from her past, her family, the Gaelic melodies.
Well, then we leave Amy and we go to Dmitri Shostakovich. And it's my understanding that the political developments in Russia and the Soviet Union really had an effect on him.
Shostakovich would not have been Shostakovich without the Soviet Union. He was the first composer to have grown up in the Soviet Union, to come of age, and to have been exclusively a product of going to Soviet music schools, working under the Soviet system. He was one of the first to really run afoul of the system. And in 1936, Joseph Stalin took exception to his opera Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, and walked out of the performance. And a couple of days later, there appeared in Pravda an editorial written by Stalin but without his name, says on the title of "Muddle instead of Music," and denouncing the music that he heard in Lady Macbeth. And at that time, it was pretty well known, where the examples were all around him, that such a denunciation could very easily lead to a late-night visit by the KGB, and you would never be seen again. It happened to many of Shostakovich's friends, including one of his great protectors, Marshal Tukhachevsky, who was supposedly a high Soviet official and was going to speak for him, and he ended up being executed. So from this point on, Shostakovich, who was the golden boy of Soviet music up to this point, lived in fear of his life. 1948, things became very, very bad again. There was an official denunciation of all music that Stalin considered to be anti-Soviet. The Soviet artists were supposed to write music and create art that embodied the principles of life is better and life is happier. And if music wasn't happy, if it didn't make you feel better, it must be decadent, it must be Western, and it could not be allowed to exist. Stalin died in 1953, and in 1958, conditions considerably lightened up for Soviet artists, and that's where we come to the concerto in 1959, shortly after this, an era that Soviet artists were beginning to be a little bit more free with their thought, but this is after a couple decades of being in fear of his life. And Shostakovich said that he would pack a bag and sit on the steps of his apartment building and wait for the KGB to come at night because he was sure that this was going to be it, so as not to disturb his wife. And so the being an intensely personal, private man anyway, a very private man, what this did over a couple decades is build up this incredible well of artistic pressure within him that only was released when he wrote music. And the 15 symphonies are the greatest symphonies of the 20th century, 15 great string quartets to go along with them, great operas, and a lot of great, very light popular music too. But he was the major Soviet composer of that era.
Well, now he... he really didn't get into the concerto form until later in his career. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's really kind of remarkable. Most composers wrote concertos all along, but when you look at the circumstances, you understand a little bit. In the 19th century and in the 18th century, composers wrote concertos so that they could perform and they could make money. In the 19th century, later on, composers wrote concertos on commission by other artists. An artist wanted a concerto by a famous composer and would pay him and to write this concerto. Well, artists didn't pay for concertos in the Soviet system. The state paid everybody. The state paid composers, and the state pretty much dictated what you could and couldn't do. So there wasn't that much of a market. Plus, Shostakovich did not seem to be, at least initially for the first several decades of his life, to be very much predisposed to writing concertos. Mstislav Rostropovich, the first concerto was written for, and one of the great cellists of the 20th century, came to know Shostakovich as a young man, studied with him, and became very close to him and wanted desperately for Shostakovich to write a concerto for him. And when asked for advice about what to do to get Shostakovich to do this, he was advised, never mention it. If you bring it up, it will never happen. So he didn't. He didn't mention it until finally Shostakovich came around to wanting to write this. And he was inspired by a piece that Prokofiev wrote, a Sinfonia Concertante, also for cello and orchestra, and Shostakovich was quite taken with the piece. And interestingly, these two concertos are considered the most difficult repertoire ever written for the cello, the most difficult solo pieces, concerto pieces ever written for the cello.
Maybe you've described it a little bit, but how would you describe the cello concerto number one?
It's so difficult to describe because it is so many things. It is simple. It is direct. It is rhythmic. It's melodic. It's profound. It's deep. It's ironic. It's humorous. It's despairing. It's everything. And written very economically for a fairly small orchestra, winds, strings, one French horn, timpani, and a very brief but very touching moment where the celesta plays in the second movement. Shostakovich himself described the first movement as a jovial march. And when he was pressed on that, he did what he characteristically did. He backpedaled and obfuscated and tried to blur the question. He didn't want to get into that very much. He didn't like to talk about his music because talking about his music could get him in trouble. He did talk about this to other people, and one of the people he spoke to about this was Kirill Kondrashin, who was my teacher, who was a good friend of Shostakovich's, and I think the foremost interpreter of his orchestral works, his symphonies. And Shostakovich spoke to Kondrashin about this and talked about some of the inner meaning, some of the struggle, some of what he was trying to get across. There was some feeling of relief that he was a little bit more free than he had been, but there was all this repressed anger, sorrow, grief, just waiting to come out. You notice something very interesting at the beginning of this piece. Without any introduction whatsoever, the solo cello enters, just playing all by itself in a melodic figure that keeps coming back over and over and over and over again. So there's no question. I mean, you remember this figure after it's been repeated 10, 20 times. And it comes off as a kind of a question. And the cello keeps asking this question. And he keeps being answered by this very unsatisfactory ba-ba-ba, ba-ba-ba in the orchestra. And it keeps going on. And you get into the second theme. The second theme, you find traces to Mussorgsky's Songs and Death of Children. songs on the death of children, and other folk songs and things like that, little bits and pieces that keep on getting snuck in. There's a tightness to this piece that that there isn't a note that's wasted. And what is really remarkable is midway through the first movement, the horn, who has been silent for the whole first movement, comes in very, very strongly and as if to have a dialogue with the cello. And there is a dialogue with cello and horn, no orchestra, that goes on for quite some time in the first movement. It's really quite striking. It's a very strong part for the solo horn. This is a piece in four movements, and the second, third, and fourth movements all flow together. The second movement. Oh, I should go. I should mention also that the DSCH motif. You can't avoid this in a lot of Shostakovich's work, and particularly in this one. Now, this requires a little bit of explanation. The notes DSCH. Okay, what is the note S? What is the note H? Well, D, we know what that pitch is. S is the German notation for E flat.
Oh.
And H is the German notation, the Germans say the name of B natural. Hmm. B in German means B flat. It's kind of their peculiarity. Well, DSCH are Shostakovich's initials rendered in the German language. And so these notes, we have a piano back here, and I'll run over and play them. I'll play them loud so you can hear this.
Going to have a mini concert here, folks.
You hear these over and over again in different permutations. Now, the opening theme is not quite this DSTH, but it's related to it. It has the same contour, the same shape. And this eighth string quartet, which is written right after this, is all permeated with DSCH. Why did he do this? He once said to somebody, well, he had to do a tribute to himself because nobody else was ever going to do it. He was going to be forgotten. Well, not true, of course.
That is amazing.
The third movement, the second movement, I should talk about this a little bit first. Second movement is a beautiful introspective movement, uses some very Russian-sounding, very folk song-like themes. It's a very sorrowful movement, as the style of a Russian lullaby, perhaps, and it melts into this third movement, which is an extended concerto, which becomes more and more agitated until launching into the fourth movement, which is kind of like a wild circus. It goes crazy. The timpani comes crashing in over and over again in places you don't expect it. And then finally, little by little, the first theme for the first movement creeps back in, but it's been transformed now. It's much wilder. It's much more assertive than it was at the beginning. So something's happened. If you consider this the first theme that you hear, kind of a first-person statement by Shostakovich of how he's feeling and whatever he might have been feeling, by the time it gets to the end of the concerto, that feeling is there, but it's been transformed. It's much more emboldened. It's much stronger than it was at the beginning. This is a piece that's very easy to listen to. It's very attractive on first hearing. And this is a piece that the more you listen to it, the more you study it, the more you realize, wow, this is great music.
Wow. Well, Alexander Hirsch is the special guest.
Yes.
Cellist. What can you tell us about him?
Young cellist from Chicago. Has a quite a remarkable pedigree. I mean, you look at the competitions he's won, and he's off to a really wonderful start in his career. There is a kind of a funny... a funny way that he came to my attention. A couple of years ago, we played the Brahms double concerto for cello and violin, and we had a father and son team playing that. Shortly before we performed that, maybe right after that, Alexander wrote to me and said, I'd like to propose playing the Brahms double concerto with you and with my father as the violinist. His father is a virtuoso violinist. And I said, well, we've just done that. Sorry. And he said, well, then I propose we play the Beethoven triple concerto with my grandfather playing the piano. And I thought, this is something. There's something about this kid. It turns out he's the youngest of four generations of very fine classical musicians, string players and pianists. And so I began doing a little research into him, and I thought, well, okay, let's give this kid a chance.
Well, it sounds exciting.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this.
All right, we're now going to visit Tchaikovsky's Capriccio Italien as the next selection on the program, which I believe he wrote while he was in Rome, ostensibly escaping the frigid weather of his homeland at the time.
This is kind of the sorbetto to the substantial appetizer, perhaps, of the of the Shostakovich concerto. This is great Tchaikovsky. It's great music. It's not profound music, but it is so well done and so attractive. It's thoroughly Italian. Tchaikovsky is in his second visit to Rome. Really fell in love with the city. He was there with his brothers, having a wonderful time, seeing the sights and enjoying the food, enjoying the weather and everything. The artwork by Raphael, by Michelangelo, he just was entranced by. And he also began to absorb some of the sounds, the local Italian sounds. The fanfare that opens the Capriccio, for instance, was the fanfare he heard played from the military barracks close to where he was, kind of the reveille in the morning. There is a tune that might have just been lifted right out of an Italian street band. It's a lilting, waltz-like tune in a very leisurely tempo, you could just imagine this band playing out in the street in the night air and people drinking wine and enjoying themselves, finally going into a wild tarantella at the end. Tchaikovsky knew the orchestra extremely well. He knew how to exploit every instrument to its utmost, and he soaked up the atmosphere and presented something so thoroughly and convincingly Italian, it's hard to believe a Russian wrote it.
So it definitely has an Italian flavor.
Oh, it's definitely Italian. This is as Italian as, you can smell the oregano, the tomato, the garlic, taste the Chianti. It is so thoroughly Italian. It's a marvelous piece.
Well, then, now, next thing we're going to do is venture into The Pines of Rome by Ottorino Respighi. And would you tell us about this composer and any influences that inspired him to write The Pines of Rome? And then he also wrote The Fountains of Rome, and he also wrote Roman Festivals.
Yes. He was from Bologna, and a violist, violist and violinist by training, and also a composer. I think maybe one of the reasons he was so entranced with writing about Rome is before he got his job in Rome teaching at the Santa Cecilia Conservatory there, he spent a year or so as the principal violist in the St. Petersburg Theater Orchestra in Russia, and said that he'd had enough of that. He moved to Rome and became just excited about all things Roman. So he wrote these, he called it the Roman Trilogy, these three pieces written they weren't written right next to each other. I don't remember how long it took him to write this, these three pieces. But he was not so much entranced with Roman music the way that Tchaikovsky was, but with all things Roman. The Fountains of Rome, goes without saying, are written about three famous Roman fountains. The Roman festivals, various traditions that the Romans engaged in, huge orchestra, by the way. And the Pines of Rome, which is probably the most popular of all of those three, most often performed. And the Pines of Rome are, why would a composer write about pines? Well, you don't really write about the pines. You write about the area that happens to have pine trees in it. And there's four areas that he writes about that are very popular among tourists, and they were back then, and they probably have been for centuries. The Eternal City, after all. The Pines of the Villa Borghese, which is a big open park. It's now open to the public, but used to be the home of the Borghese family in the 17th century. I don't remember now exactly. A place where lots of children play, and that the sound of children playing is very prominent in this first movement. Very lively, lots going on. The snippets of songs that kids might sing as when they're playing out in such a public space like this. Goes to the Pines of the Catacombs. The Catacombs, of course, where the early Christians were buried. Out in the more rural setting in Rome, still rural today, probably more so back then. Again, pine trees in the area. The pines of the Janiculum of the Travestere, which is a hill overlooking the Vatican, and a very peaceful location, sort of a refuge from the urban bustle of the city. And finally, the Pines of the Appian Way, the famous Roman road. And here, probably, and this is probably the most famous and most often heard section, he imagines what it must have been like, a Roman army marching back victorious along this road thousands of years ago, with the buccine playing, the ancient Roman trumpets. They don't exist anymore, but he has parts for six of them anyway, which are now taken up by modern instruments. It's quite a sound. It's very effective. It starts very, very quietly and builds to an enormous climax at the end. Respighi is known as a master orchestrator. And boy, do you hear it in this piece. The ingenious use of every instrument in the orchestra and the skill with which he puts it together. It's a orchestral tour de force and one of the most popular pieces of the orchestral repertory, certainly from the 20th century.
Well, this sounds very exciting. There's a lot of variety coming up here, so we look forward to hearing all of that. Now, another thing that's happening is Sound Bites is going to be starting back up again.
Yes.
So can you tell us once again what that's all about?
Sound Bites, if you are off or just in need of lunch on Friday afternoon, the day before our classic concerts, we get together at 11:30 at Monatisi Country Club, and you can order lunch there, whatever you'd like that's on the menu. And at 12 o'clock, I sit down and talk to a guest artist or somebody involved with the production that we're about to do. This particular concert, I will be talking with Alexander Hirsch. And we don't do a program notes kind of a thing. We talk about life as a musician and you know, how he got started and what it's like to bring a cello in an airplane these days and stuff like that, the fun details.
Mm-hmm. Well, that'd be great. I hope everybody goes to that. Well, the music of the Pines of Rome and other great selections are going to fill the Coronado Performing Arts Center on Saturday, September 28th at 7:30 p.m. during the Rockford Symphony Orchestra's Classics 1 concert. For more information about this concert, Sound Bites, and anything else, go to rockfordsymphony.com or call 815-965-0049. This is Phil Davidson.
And this is Steve Larson.
Thank you for listening.